Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. I'm here with Amanda Prowse, who I think prefers to be called Mandy.
I do, yeah.
Okay, Mandy Prowse.
I think I'm in trouble if you call me Amanda.
Right.
It's like a school thing, isn't it? Yeah. Amanda, get out here. And I'm like, I'm sorry. You know, apologising because probably was me.
To be fair, and yeah. Using the whole name, you know. Exactly. Amanda Prowse,
exactly.
In the hallway.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your book, A Mother's Story. But I also want to talk about your extensive yet brief writing career.
That's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Extensive yet brief. And it has been, yeah. So 3 years, and I think I've just finished my 10th novel.
Jesus.
I know. I don't sleep. I don't clean the house. Fact. I don't, you know, my children, they get no cooked food. It's like, yeah, dial the pizza number. It's fine. No, not really. But yeah, I write continually. I love it.
So you started, your first book was self-published.
Yes. I wrote it not with the intention of self-publishing. I thought, this is great. I'm going to write a book. Everyone's going to love it. And it'll be, you know, on the shelves within a month. This is fantastic.
What could be better?
Doesn't quite happen like that. But I didn't know. And I knew nothing about the publishing industry at all. And in a way, it kind of didn't... I didn't see any of the boundaries or any of the boulders that should have been in my way, which was wonderful. But on the other hand, it was incredibly disappointing not to know that the moment I'd finished my edit, then people weren't phoning up and saying, where can I buy it? I didn't realise there was this whole, you know, hoops you had to jump through to get people to read it and people to listen to you and read your work. And then if you're lucky, to get it published and get it on shelves. So Poppy Day, my first book, I finished. I write very quickly, as we've said, which I'm very fortunate at. And no one wanted to read it. I had lots of credible rejections in that people had said, yeah, no one wants to read a book about London and Afghanistan. It doesn't really fit our list. It's not quite what we're looking for. You know, what else have you had published? I'm like, nothing. This is my first. And of course, that's like a real red flag. And it was just this constant rejection, which I now know is part of writing. In the end, I managed to convince myself that every no was one step closer to getting my yes. So keep going, persevere.
The law of averages.
Exactly. Pretty much it was. After a few months of feeling quite dejected, quite down, and thinking, actually, you know, who am I kidding? Maybe I just can't do this. Maybe I'm not as good at this as I thought I was going to be after all these years of thinking, I can do that. I decided to self-publish, which we did. That book has sold a million copies worldwide. So all those publishers said no one wants to read it. They did want to read it, you know, which I'm very, very lucky. And it wasn't easy. It was a tough journey. But then, of course, it does become easy because once you've cracked the code and you have support of a publisher and an agent, it then becomes very easy. It's just the hardest part. It's getting over that first hurdle.
Yeah.
I understand why people give up before they crack it.
And what made you finally, you know, if you said for years I've been thinking I can write and I can write. But what made you finally put, you know, pen to paper, fingers to keyboard?
Yeah, I've always been an avid reader. Come from a very ordinary family. We didn't have books in our house. We weren't an academic family. My dad worked on a production line in Ford's car manufacturing. My mum was a hairdresser and stay-at-home mum. We didn't have books in our house. Maybe like a catalogue and a car manual. That was about it. So I wasn't at all from that environment. I never thought it was possible for someone like me to write a book, or even certainly not get a book published. And then when I was 32, I got diagnosed with bowel cancer, and it changed my life because I always say it was the best and the worst thing that happened to me. Mm. I was very sick, and I remember sitting opposite the desk of this consultant, and he said, I'm afraid it's good news. It's good news, he said, you know, we think it's treatable if we operate right now. Bad news is, you know, you're going to have to go through this extensive set of treatment of chemo and radiotherapy and surgery, etc. He said, and then we'll see how you go. So I said, oh, great. So we'll do that and I'll be fine. He said, well, you'll be fine for the minute. And it absolutely made me think. And I left the office and I thought, right, if this is my one time round the block and I've got another, what, month, 6 months, 60 years, who knows? What do I want to do with it? And I was working in a job that didn't really suit me. It was all about just getting the money in. But you know, when you feel like you're on a hamster wheel and the cash is coming in and you're paying the rent and you're sending the kids to nursery and you're, you know, cooking your pasta, and it's just like this routine you get in, but you're not happy. Mm. You're just doing it. And this was like one of those moments where I was outside of my life looking down, thinking, right, What do I want to change? This is it. This is my shot. This is my my shot at changing things. What do I want to do? So I gave up my job. And by that stage, I'd met my lovely husband. So I was no longer a single mum, which was great. And I was the main breadwinner. So we were completely skint. We sold everything. We sold all our possessions. We sold our car just so we could fund our lives while I wasn't working but writing. And we were literally down to our last sort of, you know, 20 quid. We didn't have money for fuel. It was a really horrible time. Can't make out it wasn't. But when you get sick like that, that puts everything into perspective. Not having any money didn't matter. Not having a car didn't matter. Not being able to go on holiday, who cares? Still being here is the bonus. And being here and doing something that really gives me joy every day is just like, it's everything. It's like winning the lottery 10 times over. I'm very lucky.
Wow. I don't think I was expecting that.
Because I'm so healthy. I always look so healthy. Yeah. And even when I was sick, I had it again 22 months ago. I had it on the top of my spine. So I'm not out of the woods yet. But I look, everyone says to me, you're so healthy. You're so vibrant. You're so, and I am, because it comes from within. Mm. I'm happy and I have a healthy persona, even though my body sometimes gets sick. So. Mm. Mm.
Well, and you came bouncing in today, and apparently we were all set to swap hair tips, because you're supposed to have long, curly hair. However,
yes, and I haven't actually spoken about it.
We have a little feathery bob going on.
My hair fell off. Yes, it was...
Not due to cancer.
No, not this time. No, thank God. But weirdly enough, I'd always kept my hair long, because I remember... someone saying to me when I first had my treatment, if your hair had been long enough, we could have made a wig out of it. And that stuck with me. I thought, right, I'm keeping this hair long, because how marvellous to still have my tresses, you know, because actually that's one of the hardest things. So I grew my hair long. And then, yes, this Saturday, a very sort of inexperienced, sweet, lovely girl in the hairdressers left my bleach on for a couple of hours. And it was that moment. As she was brushing it, I was watching her in the mirror. Her face sort of collapsed. Her hands were shaking. And I thought, uh-oh. And I sat there with most of my hair in my lap. Bless her. But you know what? It's hair. Doesn't matter.
It's hair. Doesn't matter. And did that actually mirror when that happened to you before, when it came out through chemo?
Yeah.
And her face was sort of your face then.
Yeah. And that's why it doesn't matter, because I know there's a lot worse things can happen.
And I have to say, your hair is looking fab.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to growing back.
Thank you. You know,
and then we can swap hair tips. But anywho.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
Tell us the story of A Mother's Story.
Of course. Well, A Mother's Story is the story of Jessica, who is married to Matthew. And I would say, from the outside looking in, they're sort of that young couple that have it all. She has this amazing wedding. She's met the man of her dreams. They have a beautiful home. Matthew has a great career. You know, life's pretty good. They live in Chiswick.
I used to live on the Chiswick High Road. It's literally Merton.
I was Ravenscourt Park.
Yeah, exactly.
Your poor relation right there, yeah.
Right across from there.
In fact, my bedroom was joined onto a pub wall, and it was the men's urinals. And at night, I was laying there, and I could hear men weeing in the loo. It wasn't overly... you know, unattractive, I have to say, but that's another story. So, she's living in Chiswick, and they have this great life. She has great friends. They have great sex. You know, it's kind of like this, they have it all, as I've already said. And the icing on the cake is when Jessica falls pregnant. And her life, she's preoccupied with choosing colours for the nursery, collecting tiny little socks when she wants to, you know, put in cute drawers. And she pictures the Gap ad. You know, she pictures what the media sells us, this idea of, you know, having glossy locks and a beautiful, clean, healthy baby whilst whipping up a batch of cupcakes with her left hand. And she has the baby. She has a relatively easy pregnancy, I would say, but a difficult birth, which shocks her, as it does, shocks us all. The day she holds the child for the first time, without giving too much away, she looks at this baby and, in her words, she says, "I feel less than I think I should." And things go downhill from there for her. She suffers from not only what I would call postnatal depression, but postnatal psychosis, which is a whole different thing. But it's extreme. She doesn't bond with the child. She resents the child being in her house. She doesn't like the way her husband adores this little girl. She finds it all very, very difficult. And that manifests itself in a number of ways. And we really are watching as Jessica's perfect life unravels, which is difficult and hard. But I think it's something that an awful lot of women can relate to.
I would say it was funny, I was talking to my husband and my son, and I said it was a hard book for me to read. because I too had an easy pregnancy. I thought I'd be an earth mother, I thought I'd be all hippied out and loving, and I had a difficult birth. And for the first time reading this book, I sort of look back on that as possible correlation, because it's an event that you might, have a little post-traumatic stress disorder from, but no time to even consider yourself in that.
Exactly.
Thing. It's this relentless, never-ending task.
Yeah.
And I, too, in the book, Jessica doesn't see her baby for 15 hours, and I didn't see him for 12 hours. And I think these things do make a huge difference.
They do.
And then, I mean, thank God, I definitely feel like I had some, what they call the baby blues, which really makes it sound so trivial. And what your book helps to really seamlessly demonstrate, because it doesn't seem crazy what she's thinking. I mean, it seems crazy, but you can see how it could happen. And it's also very, very... It's a well-written, but it's not a pretty look at this. Did you experience?
I did. Like you, I think I was very fortunate to have baby blues, which I think is the milder end of the spectrum for sure.
Yeah.
But I can remember feeling... I was a single mum, as I say, at the time. And I can remember just that feeling of being overwhelmed, like I was sinking, like I physically and mentally didn't know what to do. I can remember holding this child who I... adore. I've always adored him. And you see, that's another thing. Hear my guilt, the need to say, I adore him. I love him. Yeah. Because I remember those days where I felt like I wanted to run away from this thing who is the most precious. He's my heart and my anchor. So the fact that I can say I wanted to run away from him, I still have the underlying guilt. I have to almost, coat it by saying, but I love him. I love him. And I'm constantly telling him how adored he is, which he is. And he always was, but I wasn't well.
Exactly.
And
the guilt we feel in being unwell.
And you haven't got... It's what you said earlier. You haven't got the time. So, if you have the flu and your young friend's single, you might take a couple of, painkillers and hit the bed for a couple of hours. Who knows? Or hangover, what's that? Big fry up and a bit of a walk. Break your leg, put it in a cast. But when you have...
A couple of days with your legs up.
Exactly. How lovely. Quite like that, the idea of it right now. But actually, when you have a mental illness, which is what postnatal depression is, through no fault of your own, you're sick because of this chemical, this hormonal imbalance, but you're so darn tired, you can't remember how to put your socks on. And you are required 24/7 to be on duty, on high alert. So your adrenaline is running overtime, cortisol running through your body. And you're tired, and that's making you more tired. It's just this horrible downward cycle. But the biggest negative to all that is that you can't actually tell someone.
Yeah.
Because my fear, which is entirely unfounded and irrational, was that someone would take my baby away from me because I wasn't coping. So I thought I'm best to just lie. To say to all my friends and family who are wonderful, oh, this is great. Yes, it is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Yes, I adore him more than life. Yes, I'm so lucky. It's a breeze. And then when they left, I was sitting in the bathroom with the door locked, sobbing, thinking, please let him just sleep. Please let him sleep, because I know what to do when he's asleep. I can cope with that. The moment he woke up, I remember thinking, please go back to sleep. I wanted him to sleep 24/7 because that's how I could cope with it, which is... sad for me because I missed out some really fantastic times, and sad for him because he didn't have the most positive parenting available, because I didn't get the help I needed.
Me either. And I feel like it probably went on longer because of that.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Yeah.
And she is also surrounded, it sounds to me like you were surrounded, by people who loved you and would have done anything, to help you out.
You're right. But it wasn't about that. It was about, I didn't realise what I was going through.
Yeah.
And it says in the beginning of the book, it's as though someone comes up behind you with this big black cloak and throws it over your head. And by the time you realise what's happening, it's too late. And I did a lot of research for the book. I always do. I write about very sensitive and emotive subjects that actually, if they weren't fiction, no one would want to talk about. But by turning them into a story, it makes it accessible. It makes us much more comfortable in talking about it. And I spoke to an awful lot of women. I did 10 case studies, And my beautiful women that came forward and shared their, bravely shared their stories, range from a new young mum who was 22 to Ivy, who was 84.
Wow.
And the crazy thing is, the amazing thing was that the words they used, the phrases they gave me, were interchangeable. I got one story at the end of it, because all these women said the same thing. You know, they felt motherhood is the most natural thing in the world. Why can't I do it? Why is the lady in the supermarket able to cope and not me? How come my neighbour is back in her skinny jeans and is able to push this clean, healthy baby around, and I'm still wearing dirty pyjamas at 5 in the evening and I haven't even managed to make a cup of tea? All the comparisons, woman to woman, woman to woman. And the one thing that made me feel, I feel passionate about, is come on, sisterhood. Mm-hmm. Put arms around women who have new babies, who are pregnant. You know, we don't have to be the bringer of bad news and gloom and doom stories, you know. We don't. That's not what I'm talking about. But we all know what it's like to have someone just put an arm around you and be a bit of a buddy at a time when you might really need it. We should all be on high alert for that. Yeah. Women supporting women, getting other women through by encouraging and just giving love in the way that we can best.
Hmm. What allowed you to write this story now?
Time that's elapsed. Yeah. And yeah. I have a stunning, healthy, happy, beer drinking, rugby playing, swearing, gaming, 6'4" monster, who is my absolute pride and joy. I adore him. I adore my son. And I'm well and healthy mentally. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to look back at it and think, okay, I came out the other side. But it's the buffer of good years and the buffer of my child's success in that he's happy.
Yes.
And he's grown and he's great. Yes. You know, it's that buffer that allows me to look back and feel comfortable about talking about a time when I felt it was all slipping through my fingers.
And I've been, you can see the evidence that you've been a good enough mother. You launched one.
Exactly.
You know, I said launched. Exactly. You're like, all right.
Well, yeah.
Exactly. I'm out of the woods now.
He's so far from perfect. You know, if only we could get him to pick up the wet towels. And I found cups with penicillin under his bed the other day. I'm like, well, how long have these been here? And yeah, getting the old motivation in, but you know, he's hilarious. And I never thought I could love him more than when he was tiny. I'd watch him sleep and think, look at you, you're just so amazing. But I still feel that. He's nearly 19. I still got him. Cringe if you heard me saying this. But I still love to just study his face. He's like, what are you looking at? I'm like, sorry. I just stare at him and think, I grew this. Look at him. You know, he's amazing. Yeah.
But I just say, hearing you said it when he's asleep, because I remember as soon as my son was not a good sleeper, which did not help things, and as soon as he falls asleep, this rush of love and gratitude, you know.
But that's really key. I heard that a lot. You know why? Because you actually then switch off the panic.
Yes.
Ah, okay. It's like I'm rushing today. I was late to meet you, and I apologise. But I rush in. It's like, that panic, that stress, that high level, and suddenly, okay,
and that's fine.
And that's the moments when they were sleeping that you're able to fully enjoy and relax.
Yes.
And no pressure on you. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to know what to do. You can just let them sleep.
Yeah.
You know.
That was the one time we knew what to do.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
Which is also so hard because, you know, she's not an older mother, but she's an unprepared mother.
Absolutely.
And I just, you know, like being, going from a point in my life where I'd been so capable to being wildly incapable.
That I love that you've brought that up, because one of the key factors I found from all my research was women who I felt were more prone to suffer were what I would call super copers.
Mm-hmm.
Women who ran a house, who had relationships, who had friends, who had a wide social network, who held down a career, who did a job, whatever. They were super copers. So suddenly this thing came along and they can't cope. So almost it was like not only the impact on them, their mental health and their feeling of confidence was greater because they weren't used to that failure in their eyes, failure.
Yeah.
There's something in it. I really do.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm. So what are you delving into now?
Well, my next book comes out in July, and it's called The Perfect Daughter. And it's about a woman who, like many women nowadays, finds themselves caring for older parents, younger kids, grandchildren. And hang on, this lady wakes up one day, looks in the mirror and thinks, well, what about me? You know, I'm caring for my mother who has dementia, which is incredibly tough. I'm looking after my kids, who are 19 and 7, as they are. There are grandchildren. There are pressures that they have no money. They're hard up. You know, the house is cramped and getting smaller. The older they get, the more stuff everyone gets, the smaller the house gets, until she feels she's squeezed to this point where she's going to just disappear. Mm. And it's that awakening for her and what that unleashes into her family. There are so many women living under that pressure, that weight of trying to do it all, to be all things to all people. And she says, I feel like I'm grieving, but I don't know what I'm grieving for. And she looks in the mirror and she says, I'm grieving for the loss of me. I've lost me. And all the things I thought I might become when I was younger, I realise I'm not going to do any of them because this is my life.
I'm stuck here in the middle.
And the end is what no one would expect. You know, it's quite an unusual book. It's a very ordinary book, as all my books are. My books are always very ordinary. You know, I talk about the fact that in one of my books, Poppy Day, the very first scene, a guy comes to knock on the door to tell her husband's been taken hostage in Afghanistan. Her first thought is, oh, God, my flat smells of fish. Because, you know what? Yeah. That's what we do. So they're always very ordinary women who have ordinary reactions and impulses, which I think is where people can relate to them.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And also, as you know, going back to a mother's story, we could also relate to all the judgment that Jessica undergoes as well.
Yeah.
You know, like, why aren't you coping? Like, pull yourself together.
What have you done all day?
Yeah.
Why is it so hard? What else are you doing? You haven't cooked dinner. You haven't managed to wash your hair. It's very hard, if you haven't suffered, to explain the enormity of that feeling of being overwhelmed.
Well, it's even hard to explain to yourself.
It is, absolutely.
You know, it's like, yeah, I haven't managed to get dressed.
No,
you
exactly.
Know?
Did you have those days?
Yes. Yeah. I remember it was a beautiful day, and thinking everyone else is outside in this day, and I can't get out there. I can't even get out there.
When did you know that you were feeling a bit better?
When did I know I was feeling better? It started happening in glimmers of those, just, and I can feel it now rising up in me, these euphoric moments.
Yeah.
Where it's sort of almost a sob of euphoria.
Yes, yeah.
Comes up, and I'm like, I'm having this incredible time.
Yeah.
We can laugh. We can do this.
Yeah.
It's okay. I can do this. You can do this.
Like breaking up.
Exactly. I haven't killed you. I haven't ruined your life.
Yeah.
Yet. And today's okay.
Yeah. And Jessica says, she says, I feel it was like being able to break through the surface and take a breath.
Yeah.
And weirdly for me, I knew when I was feeling better because I went outside. It was a really tiny thing, but I would do anything to avoid having to get the baby ready, get myself ready and leave the house. Mm. The house was my refuge and my prison. And I remember one day getting up and my mum saying, I didn't live near my parents, which didn't help or any of my family, really. I felt quite isolated. And I can remember one day thinking, oh gosh, I need coffee. You know, there's a motivator right there. No coffee. Hello. You know, how far do I have to walk? I'll do it. And I remember getting up and I don't think I showered, but I think I put clean clothes on, shoved my hair in a ponytail, got my son washed and dried, put clothes on him, put him in the pram. And I was outside. I remember thinking, I'm outside. I did it. Mm-hmm. I've got him ready. I'm here. And I felt literally, as you say, euphoric. Mm-hmm. And all I'd managed to do was walk over a threshold of a step. But then I thought, okay, I need to do this. So every day I got out of that house. I broke out of my prison. And then I started talking to people. Mm-hmm. And then I started opening up more. I started feeling more like me. And I knew I was getting better.
Yeah. Sounding even to yourself more like yourself.
Exactly. And the good news is there is so much help out there. That's really important. You know, I don't think it always was quite so hopeful.
No.
I think back in the day, you know, Ivy, who I spoke to, said that it was a case of people would say to her, well, just pull yourself together. Get on with it. And she remembers, she told me something. She said, I have changed her name, obviously, so I'm not breaking any confidence. But she says, I remember talking to my mother-in-law and saying, did you ever feel slightly overwhelmed? And her mother-in-law said, well, you know, no, I didn't have time to feel overwhelmed. I was too busy. I was cleaning the house and cooking the dinner. She said, even she made me feel so diminished as though, gosh, yes, she's right. All I have to do is this one thing and I can't. So she said, I didn't mention it to anyone else. Mm. But now, of course, know, there's some fantastic charities, there's helplines, there's other women you can talk to, community groups, NCT, local library, all these different resources, free resources out there that you can go and grab and get help and support, which is wonderful.
Excellent. Mandy, thank you so much.
I loved it. That was really nice. Nice chat. I loved it. Thank
Excellent.
You.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
Wonder where she is bound. I broke her heart and made her cry. Now I'm alone, so all alone. What can I do? What can I do? There goes my baby. Whoa, whoa, whoa. There goes my baby. Hey.
Why did she